Good morning, Honorable Minister, our team, the media, and the public that has joined us today for this meeting. Honorable members, I wish to welcome everybody in this inquiry of today, which has raised so much media attention, hoping that we are going to do well as usual in this meeting. Minister, you are welcome in the meeting with your legal team and everybody who you have come with from your office. Any apologies?
Yes, Honorable Chairperson, the apologies I have received is from Mr. Kwankwa, Mr. Singh, and Mr. Marais.
Thank you. Hopefully the apologies are being accepted by members. Members, the agenda is in front of everybody. Our third item in the agenda is inquiry into corporate governance at Eskom. And we have Honorable Minister Malusi Gigaba in front of us. Before we get the presentation from the minister has agreed that he is going to take an oath. Can we switch off our cell phones? Not off, put them on silent, please. I know other people cannot handle them, cannot manage their cell phones because others are new. Maybe it's a new gadget. Ask somebody next to you to help you with the new gadget. It's always difficult to use them. Minister, I am now going to read the oath to you. I hope the document is in front of you. Okay. Inquiry into state-owned enterprises. The oath is, in accordance with Section 16 of the Powers, Privileges and Immunities of Parliament and Provincial Legislature Act 2004, as a witness to this oversight inquiry, please be informed that by law you are required to answer fully and satisfactorily all questions lawfully put to you, or to produce any document that you are required to produce in connection with the subject matter of the inquiry, notwithstanding the fact that the answer or the document could incriminate you or expose you to criminal or civil proceedings or damages. You are, however, protected in that evidence given under oath before a house or committee may not be used against you in any court or place outside Parliament except in criminal proceedings concerning a charge of perjury or a charge relating to the evidence or documents required in these proceedings. Please be aware that in terms of Section 17(2) of the Powers, Privileges and Immunities of Parliament and Provincial Legislature Act, a person who willfully vanishes a house or committee with information or makes statements before it which is false or misleading, commits an offence and is liable to a fine or to imprisonment for a period not exceeding 2 years. You are therefore required, Minister, to take the oath. You read what is in the paper at the second page. Thank you. No, you can be seated. It's
I swear, should I say my names or just read as written? Okay. I swear that the evidence I shall give shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So help me God.
Thank you very much, Honorable Minister, for that. You can sign it, and somebody will come and take it from you. Honorable members, today we are going to get a presentation by the minister to us. The proceedings of today will go like this. We'll get the proceedings. We'll get the presentation from the minister. We will then have questions. The first people to question the minister today will be the members. And after that, we will see if the evidence leader will have time to get in and ask questions. But we will open for him also to ask questions. Honorable Shivam.
Chair, what informs that upside-down approach when it comes to Mr. Gigaba? Isn't that the procedure is that the evidence leader should take him through what he's going to present, ask the base questions, and then members come afterward to then make follow-up on that? Well, what makes us to depart from the standard procedure of this inquiry? Can we please do it in the manner that we've been doing it with other witnesses? Please.
Thank you, Honorable Shivambo. Advocate, can you respond to that?
Thanks, Chair. It is a request that I had made to the Honorable Chair. But if the committee is not inclined to accept that request, it's fine. I will engage.
Honorable Nobanda,
Honorable
Dlamini, Honorable Luyende.
Thank you, Chair. I think if the evidence leader saw it fit that he would come at the end and requested that, maybe we should give him that opportunity. Maybe he has valid reasons that he cannot explain to us now why he wants to be at the end. But at the end of the day, we are all going to ask questions. He's also going to ask questions. I don't think there's a transmission.
Honorable Zamin.
Thank you, Chairperson. That request has been denied. So the evidence leader must ask questions, and we follow the processes that we've been following here. We're not going to make any exception. Thank you.
Honorable Luyeng.
No, thanks, Chairperson. Maybe, Chair, in the interest of time, I don't think the evidence leader has a problem in continuing in the manner in which we were doing this, because maybe other people out there will think that there is a certain trick that we want to do, and why change now? Why it has not been the case before? But I think let's allow the process to continue as usual, because he has already indicated the evidence leader that no, there is no transmission that.
Thank you, honourable members. I will now give over to the minister to present.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you, honourable members. I think before I delve into my presentation, let me make two statements. The first one being that we have furnished you this morning with a final version. It unfortunately is written draft 21. That's only an editorial matter. It's the final version of the statement which I will be making. It is an update from the one I submitted yesterday night. And so if members could refer rather to the statement which I submitted this morning. Those were the two initial statements, both made in one. I have been called, Chairperson, to account for my tenure at the Department of Public Enterprises from November 2010 until May 2014. Before I begin, I would like to commend the committee for the work it is doing for upholding the democratic process. I welcome the opportunity granted to me to address the concerns around allegations of state capture insofar as I'm able to do. I am further grateful for the extension granted to me to peruse the relevant documentation. I have had to request large volumes of documents from the Department of Public Enterprises. I requested these in batches as I became aware of their necessity, and some of them have not yet arrived. Consequently, if this committee has any questions that pertain to outstanding documentation, I will undertake to answer those in a further written submission upon receipt of the outstanding documents. For the time being, however, I ask the committee to note that my testimony today is based on my memory and on confidential documents that were provided to me. I have no issue providing these documents to Parliament should their confidentiality be lifted. I take seriously both the allegations that have been made in relation to state capture and my opportunity to address them. It has been disheartening and shocking for me to witness some of the appointments that I made years ago and which were hailed publicly as positive appointments for government now being impugned. I take seriously the task of assisting this committee in uncovering the extent of corruption that appears to have transpired. The period for which I am expected to account covers approximately 3.5 years. I requested clarity from this committee as to what was expected of me, and I received a response indicating that I am required to do 4 things. The first is to account for Mr. Dame's testimony. The second is that I am expected to account for governance at ESCOM. The third is that I am required to account for all board appointments made to Transnet, DINEL and ESCOM during my tenure at DPE. And lastly, I am required to address the issue of any alleged Gupta-linked contracts that may have been concluded at ESCOM, DINEL and Transnet during my DPE tenure. To avoid confusion and repetition, I am going to structure my submission to deal with the above topics in the following order. First, I will discuss corporate governance at ESCOM during my tenure. Then I will address what I consider to be the material and relevant portions of Mr. Dame's testimony before this committee. And I will then deal with the additional aspects required by the committee, such as clarity on board appointments, governance and contracts. Brian's testimony included 4 aspects that I consider as being relevant to me. The first aspect was the allegation about the meeting between my then legal advisor, Mr. Siyabonga Mahlangu, and a Gupta brother. The second issue raised was the alleged difference in the quality of governance and structure between the board led by Mr. Magwana and board as it was led by Mr. Zola Tsotsi. The third pertinent issue was Mr. Dame's resignation, and the last topic pertaining to me that he dealt with was the Kubel steam generator contract. I was asked to address governance at ESCOM. This request was not clarified by the committee, so I will respond by outlining governance in very broad terms. And I also want to set out the basic governance framework in which the minister, specifically the Minister of Public Enterprises, operates, and in terms of which the minister is empowered in respect of certain actions and constrained in terms of others. From the onset, Section 66 of the Companies Act regulates the powers of the Board of Directors. In terms of structure, the state-owned companies have unitary board structures, meaning they consist of a single board with both executive and non-executive directors. The board chairperson, chief executive, chief finance director and non-executive directors are appointed by the shareholder. I will discuss details of those appointments later. The directors are drawn from diverse backgrounds and bring wide-ranging experiences and professional skills on the board. These skills are supplemented by external members of the at committee level. The performance of the board and individual directors is evaluated each year. The term of non-executive directors is between 3 and 5 years, depending on the particular SOC's memorandum of incorporation and is subject to review at the annual general meeting. Retiring directors are eligible for reappointment. The management of day-to-day operations is delegated to the Chief Executive Officer. The Chief Executive is supported by the Executive Management Committee and its subcommittees. Relating to government specifically, all the state-owned companies under the Department of Public Enterprises, including ESCOM, adhere to a myriad of laws, legislation and codes, including the Companies Act of 2008 and the Public Finance Management Act of 1999. King 3, the Protocol on Corporate Governance in the Public Sector, and various international benchmarks regarding best practice, such as OECD guidelines. All state-owned companies are answerable to government. I, in my capacity as Minister of Public Enterprises from November 2010 until May 2014, was the shareholder representative of the government and had oversight responsibility for the state-owned companies in the portfolio of the Department of Public Enterprises. Relating to governance, I would like to outline for the committee the general process followed by the DPE during my tenure in appointing the state-owned companies board, board subcommittees and executives. I would like to deal with the extent to which the Minister of Public Enterprises, the ministers of public enterprises are involved in procurement. What I am about to set out is the normal practice. There is usually some deviation relating to the processes in various state-owned companies depending on their MOIs. In respect of board appointments, the process commences in the run-up to the AGM of the various state-owned companies. Prior to the AGM, the minister is presented with a motion relating to certain board appointments, which will become part of the resolutions taken at the AGM. The motion normally covers the proposed reappointment, appointment or retirement or rotation of serving board members. The motion is usually submitted to the minister well before the AGM. And when it is received, the department then evaluates the names and submits a memorandum to the minister detailing the period served by board members and which board members should therefore be reappointed or retired. If there are vacancies on the board, the department will recommend to the minister candidates to fill those vacancies. When the department conducts skills audits and discovers that there are skills gaps on the board, the department also recommends candidates to fill those positions. The names of candidates are sourced widely, including from recommendations by company or board itself, from a database maintained by the DPE and updated through periodic calls for public nominations and others. When the department recommends candidates to the minister, it does so by providing a rationale for the proposed appointment, and the minister is also provided with the resumes of the candidates. Once the minister has applied his mind to these candidates or her mind and given their approval, the preferred candidate's profile then serves before the relevant cabinet committee, and only then does it serve before cabinet. Cabinet approves all board appointments, including executive directors who are ex officio board members. I then also deem it necessary to set out how subcommittees are constituted, in order to dispel any notion of interference by me in the establishment of allegedly problematic subcommittees at ESCOM, DINEL and Transnet. All subcommittees are the business of and are appointed by the board. This is consistent with the Companies Act. The only committee that comes to the Minister of Public Enterprises' attention is the Audit and Risk Subcommittee, because the state-owned companies' MOIs provide that at the AGMs, the board must present for my approval the members and the chair of the Audit and Risk Subcommittee. It is standard practice and common courtesy for the chair of the relevant SOC to send a letter to the DPE after their AGMs, setting out how the relevant subcommittees are constituted, but those letters hardly ever reach the minister's attention, primarily because the minister has no practical interest in who is on what committee. This is because if the minister wishes to interact with an SOC, that minister will either meet the chair or call a special general meeting. In other words, the minister does not engage with subcommittees because subcommittees are the domain of the board. I would also wish to outline the appointment of executives at the state-owned companies. As I mentioned above, Cabinet has established a principle that the appointment of CEOs and CFOs must be recommended to Cabinet for approval and not just for noting, as is the position with other directorships. While I am on this topic, I also want to draw a distinction between acting and permanent appointments. Acting appointments are within the exclusive purview of the board. The board simply informs the minister, and the minister doesn't need to inform cabinet. The position is different for permanent appointments, which is the position I set out earlier. I hope that this clarifies for the committee the role played by specifically the Minister of Public Enterprises in the appointments of board and committees of the state-owned companies. And I further hope that it dispels the incorrect notion that ministers are at liberty to interfere in board committee appointments. The reality is the minister is severely constrained, and in reality, just one cog in a very large wheel of SOC board approval mechanisms. Having dealt with the board, I want to move on to the minister's role in procurement at state-owned companies. The short answer is that the Minister of Public Enterprises does not have a role in procurement. The only time that procurement issues serve before the minister is when certain large tenders require PFMA approval and are therefore submitted to both the Minister of Finance and of Public Enterprises. Let me explain when this happens. Materiality thresholds are determined at every SOC. Materiality thresholds are the amounts at which tenders require Section 54 PFMA approval from the minister. They are different at each SOC because they are determined, among others, by asset values. If a proposed tender value falls below the threshold, the minister's approval is not required, and the minister is usually not notified of those procurement initiatives. If the threshold is exceeded, however, the SOC needs to apply to the minister for PFMA approval. I must make it perfectly clear that even in instances where the minister's approval is required, the minister is kept at arm's length throughout the process. First of all, the Section 54 approval request should go to the minister before the tender goes out. And if there is any overlap, the minister is not apprised of who the bidders or potential bidders are. There is no scope for interference. When the minister considers the approval, he simply considers the business case before him and either approves or rejects the request on that basis. I must unequivocally set it out that I at no stage established a procurement committee, as this would be outside my purview. That concludes what I have to say on the general procurement practices. I now want to progress to specific details that were required of me by this committee. I have then been asked to address the Committee on Executive Appointments during my tenure at DPE. This request was two-pronged. Firstly, the committee asked for clarity on the process of appointing all board members during my tenure at DPE, which I hope I provided above. Second, my testimony is required in relation to allegations of undue influence allegedly exerted by me on the appointment of board members. I will address these questions chronologically and factually in relation to Eskom, DINEL, and Transnet, beginning with Eskom. Chairperson, on the matter of Mr. Brian Dame's testimony relating to the Gupta meeting in Midrand, I will begin with this meeting. Mr. Dame made mention during his testimony that my advisor during my tenure, Mr. Siyabonga Mahlangu called Mr. Brian Dames to set up a meeting in Midrand to see some people and to discuss official ESCOM business. Brian thinks that one of the attendees at this meeting was one of the Gupta brothers. Mr. Dames went further, stating that at the meeting they discussed requests for coal contracts to Litabo coal station in the Free State and requests for another coal power station to be built in the Free State after Medupi and Kusile were completed. This new coal power station was referred to as Coal 3. According to Mr. Dames, he received a call from Mr. Mahlangu. I did not know anything about this phone call, nor did I have any knowledge of the scheduling of the meeting. To this end, I think it is relevant that Mr. Dames, in his evidence, did not say that I called the meeting. This is both fair and accurate. I can also tell you that Mr. Dames did not call me about this meeting either before it happened or afterwards. The first time I heard of this meeting was following his testimony to this inquiry. If anything about the meeting made Mr. Dames uncomfortable, I would go as far as to say that he should have called me about this. We had a good working relationship and we communicated often. Furthermore, this is the first time I have heard about a request to provide coal to Litabo and for a coal 3 specifically to be built in the Free State. On the alleged degeneration of the board, let me now deal with Mr. Dames' testimony about the quality and cohesiveness of the Makwana board compared to the quality of the Tsotsi board. Let me address the problems with the board that confronted me as soon as I arrived at DPE. Members of the board, including Mr. Makwana, but with the exception of two appointments that I retained when the board was refreshed, had served on the board for longer than 9 years. This had been brought to my attention by a presentation the department made to me. After having had sight of the presentation, I was of the view that the board needed rotation in order to comply with good corporate governance with respect to two issues. Firstly, was the rotation of board members who had served for a lengthy period. Second, it was revising the mandate of the executive chairman to be a non-executive director and chairman to avoid overlap between the role of board chairperson and CEO of the entity. Having concluded my explanation about the ESCOM boards and their quality, that brings me to the next issue being Brian's resignation. Let me say at the outset, so there is no uncertainty about my position, that when Mr. Dames resigned from his position at ESCOM, it was a loss to the company. Let me elaborate how his resignation unfolded according to my recollection. Mr. Dames was already CEO when I arrived at the DPE. I had and still have the highest regard for him. Mr. Dames submitted two resignations to the board. When he initially wanted to leave ESCOM, I convinced him to stay on. I was not in favor of his exit from ESCOM because of his capability, integrity, and strong leadership, which brought stability and instilled confidence among ESCOM's stakeholders. Therefore, I thought it was important for him to stay. I recall having told the board that ESCOM could not afford to lose Mr. Dames at that time because of the massive build programs that ESCOM was undertaking and because they needed to raise capital in respect of those build projects. It was a critical time for ESCOM, and Mr. Dames was needed to maintain company stability during that period. It seemed to me that there were tensions between Mr. Dames and some members of the board, which could have become a distraction. I intervened, and I recall having informed Mr. Tsotsi at a meeting once in my residence in Pretoria that, quote-unquote, Brian is not going anywhere. I maintained this position until he finally tendered his second resignation in 2013, when it became clear that the tensions between him and Mr. Tsotsi could not be resolved. At that stage, the board accepted his resignation and I urged them to focus on transitional arrangements. I speak sincerely when I say that I endeavored to the best of my ability to ensure Mr. Dames remained at Eskom. And it was unfortunate to have lost his services. In the end, he left Eskom 2 months before I myself was redeployed from DPE. The last issue I want to deal with is in relation to Mr. Dames' testimony that is Quebec steam generator tender. I want to firstly clarify the reasons that the process had to be restarted. And the reasons for this are simple. The Quebec steam generator was a large tender. It was above Eskom's materiality threshold. Because of this, it needed my approval under Section 54 of the PFMA and that of National Treasury. I remember that Section 54 approval letters had been sent to me on a Wednesday. I can't recall the exact date. And the very next day, when I was reading the application documents, I received a request that I needed to speed up the approval. I called the department and queried this. I told them that I only received these documents the previous day and that I could not be rushed to make a decision. I needed to study the documents and apply my mind. In response to my query, I discovered that Eskom had already called the company that was going to supply the generators and they were ready to sign the contract. In other words, Eskom was going to sign the contract before I had even finished applying my mind to the documents that were in front of me. I was being expected merely to rubber stamp the Section 54 application instead of approve it, and I was not willing to do that. I also recall that the department had found that the process was flawed on account of the recommended bidder being informed before my approval. It was for these two reasons that I therefore refused to grant the Section 54 approval, and I told Eskom to start the process afresh in order not to compromise it. I understood, of course, that Eskom was under pressure to deliver on the bill project, but that couldn't be allowed to jeopardize the entire process. That's why I refused to approve the Section 54 application at that time, at that stage. This concludes my comments on Mr. Dames' testimony for the time being, and should the committee have any further questions afterwards, I will, of course, answer to them. I will now address what have been deemed to be significant board and executive appointments at Eskom. In this respect, I will address the reconstitution of the board in 2011, Ms. Tulufelo Mlife's appointment as the CFO, and the recruitment of a new CEO at Eskom during my tenure. Before I begin, it may help the committee to note for the sake of clarity that Eskom's Articles of Association at the time stipulated that the shareholder appointed the chairman, the chief executive, and the non-executive directors after consultation with the board. Of course, this had to be approved by cabinet ultimately. There has been a lot of talk about my decision to reconstitute the board at Eskom in 2011. I will address this first. I addressed the prolonged tenures that had been served by many board members while I was dealing with Mr. Dames' testimony. That was the reason for the decision I took in May 2011, after an audit of the board had been completed. I therefore shall not rehash it now. I recommended at the time that two board members, Dr. Benny Fanaroff and Dr. Boni Mehlomakulu, be retained for continuity, and that the following candidates should be appointed as non-executive directors. First, Zola Tsotsi was appointed as the new chairperson. Mr. Tsotsi presented an eminently qualified candidate. He held a BSc degree in mathematics and chemistry and an honors in chemical engineering. Prior to his appointment as chair of the Eskom board, he held the position of finance and administration director at RPP Pipe Support and Bellows. He had been MD of Maisha Energy and had held many prior positions at Eskom, such as corporate consultant, corporate strategy manager, and corporate environmental affairs manager. His work background provided him with a notable skill set in government policy advice and implementation, strategic management of companies, and management of administrative and financial performance of companies. Second, Mr. Colin Machila was appointed because of his skills in transformation, corporate governance, and economic development. Mr. Machila had previously been chairman of the National Energy Regulator of South Africa. Third,
Ms. Yasmin Masitela was appointed because of her extensive risk management experience and her many years in the corporate sector. She also held a master's in tax law, an LLB, and higher diploma in company law. Fourth, Surprise Sidibe was appointed because of his wealth of experience from numerous executive positions. Fifth, Neo Lisela was appointed because of her industrial engineering background and her experience in program management. Sixth, Mr. Mafika Mkwanazi was appointed because he was at the time the chairperson of Transnet and had a wealth of experience acting in CEO positions, for example at Metro Rail and Transnet. We also wanted him to help create alignment between the two entities with respect to the road to rail migration program. He was also qualified with a BSc degree in mathematics, applied mathematics and electrical engineering. In August 2011, a further three NEDs were appointed to fill vacancies on the board. They were one, Ms. Jabu Luthuli, who was a chartered accountant skilled in risk management, project management, labor relations and strategic planning. Two, Ms. Kwindi Kungubele, skilled in human resources management, labor relations and strategic planning. And three, Ms. Diatile Zondo, who was a chartered accountant with skills in auditing and strategic management. I trust that gives sufficient detail as to the appointment of the board. To summarize, the main reason for the reconstitution was to bring the board into line with good governance principles under the King Code and to retire directors who had been on the board for unacceptably long periods. I will now turn to deal with the next topic, Ms. Tulufelo Mlife's appointment to the board as CFO. The appointment of Ms. Mlife as financial director of Eskom had also caused a stir, because the incorrect public perception appears to have been that her competitor for the position, Mr. Ignatius Sehule, was, or on the face of it, appeared more qualified than she did. I will outline what in fact happened and why, as the shareholder, I refused to approve Mr. Sehule's appointment and instead confirmed Ms. Mulife's appointment. On 7 October 2013, the ministry received a letter from Mr. Tsotsi, the chairperson of Eskom at the time, requesting approval for the appointment of Mr. Sehule as the financial director of Eskom. In terms of the MOI of Eskom at the time, the board evaluated, nominated and appointed a candidate, provided that the shareholder supported each candidate. In the event that the shareholder did not approve the candidate could not be appointed, and the board would have to nominate an alternative candidate. In summary, I needed to support and endorse the candidate. I received advice in the form of a decision memorandum from the DDG of Legal and Governance in DPE on this topic on 29 November 2013. It was clear that Mr. Sehule was the board's preferred candidate at that time. However, Ms. Mulife's name also appeared as one of the top names on the list that had been provided to me. The department had identified certain concerns about the recruitment process pertaining to Mr. Sehule's proposed appointment, and I was advised of this. Firstly, the letter recommending Mr. Sehule had omitted relevant documentation. In addition to these shortcomings, I also had numerous other problems with the proposed appointment of Mr. Sehule. First, Woodburn Man, the headhunting agency, had produced a report that indicated that Mr. Sehule had difficulty working in political environments. While this may ordinarily not seem to be a problem, Eskom is a public entity and therefore has a political role. The executive directors must be able to hold their own in political environments, and doubts had been expressed to me about Mr. Sehule's ability to do this. Secondly, I was also alerted to the fact that it would be difficult for the department to meet his current remuneration package. At the time, he was receiving guaranteed annual remuneration of 4.5 million rand with a bonus of 4.2 million rand. Eskom's prior CFO had earned a total remuneration of 5.9 million rand. Lastly, and of great concern to me, was that the proposed appointment of Mrs. Ihule gave no consideration to gender parity. The majority of executive directors on the boards of state-owned companies were male at the time. I did not want to be responsible for perpetuating gender inequality if I could justifiably avoid doing so by ensuring that a competent female candidate was appointed. To that end, I had in front of me Ms. Mulifa's CV, which indicated that she was well qualified for the role, and I was of the opinion that she would capably fulfill the role of CFO if appointed. Ms. Mulifa's name was one of the top three candidate names given to me, but there had been no cogent reason given for denying her the appointment. To assuage any doubt of Ms. Mulifa's qualification for the role, her brief background was that, one, she had a BCom honors and had qualified as a chartered accountant. Two, she had joined ESCOM in 2005 already as a finance manager. Three, she was soon thereafter promoted to divisional executive. And four, she had been reporting directly to the CEO at the time and served as an executive committee member. Overall, the concern was that Mr. Sihule's remuneration would prove a challenge, and I was concerned about the reservations he had expressed about working in political environments. Additionally, Ms. Mulifa, who was a qualified and experienced chartered accountant, female, and had developed through the ESCOM ranks, was apparently, according to the advice memorandum I received, also considered favorably by the selection committee, but no cogent reason had been given for not having favored her possible appointment. I raised my concerns with the board. The board subsequently reviewed their decision and recommended that Ms. Mulifa be appointed. I had no hesitation in approving the appointment for the reasons stated above. That concludes my submissions on Ms. Mulifa's appointment. While it may or may not be contentious, I also feel it is prudent to deal with and explain the fact that a new CEO was not appointed at ESCOM after Mr. Dames resigned. Mr. Dames had resigned from ESCOM in November 2013. He was scheduled to leave the company on the 31st of March 2014. The ESCOM board needed to appoint a new CEO. The board needed to do so in consultation with me. This did not happen during my tenure. When I left DPE in May 2014, a new CEO had still not been appointed. Close to the end of Mr. Dames' resignation period, the ministry received a letter from Mr. Tsotsi. According to the letter, the board recommended that a special committee for the recruitment and identification of the CEO be constituted to review the three top candidates at the time. I did not know who these were. Along with the request, I was asked to sanction the appointment of an acting CEO while the recruitment process was undertaken. The names I was given for the role of acting CEO were, one, Mr. Dan Marukane, who was the Group Executive Technology, two, Dr. Steve Lennon, who was the Group Executive for Sustainability, and three, Mr. Nzokolo, who was the Group Executive for Transmission. With respect to the appointment of the interim CEO, I deferred to the board on that decision, as I believed it was their responsibility. Those are the only board activities which I can recall as being somewhat contentious in relation to ESCOM. That concludes my submissions on the ESCOM board, and I will now proceed to deal with DINEL. Chairperson, one appointment at DINEL during my DPE tenure, which has been questioned, was the appointment of Mr. Salucci and the extension of his term. In terms of DINEL's memorandum of incorporation at the time, the shareholder appointed the chairman and directors. All executive directors who were appointed by the board all executive directors were appointed by the board, whereas the CEO and CFO had to be approved by the shareholder. I, however, did not form part of the interview process. On the 15th of November 2011, I received a decision memorandum from the acting DDG of CIPM at DPE. In terms of this memorandum, I was advised that the contract of the DINEL Group CE, Talib Sadiq, was coming to an end on 31 December 2011. I was further advised that the board had conducted internal as well as external searches, assisted by an executive search company for the best candidate. It is important to note that Mr. Sadiq had indicated that he had no intentions to have his contract renewed. The board recommended Mr. Salucci, who was their preferred candidate. Mr. Salucci was at that time the CEO of SAP SA, had previously been the vice president of SAP International and the group executive of SAP Green Tech Defense. He was also the chairperson of the Air Force Reserve Council. His track record having been a CEO at Dow Aerospace, Metatech and Green Tech Integrated Defense Systems spoke for his executive capabilities. He was academically qualified after having completed the SANDF Joint Staff Course, equivalent to a master's degree, and other developmental management courses. I approved the decision memorandum on the 18th of November 2011 and signed both attached documents. Mr. Salucci's appointment to the role was effective from 1 January 2012 for a period of 3 years. In May 2013, the department received a letter from the DINEL chairperson concerning the review of the term of office of Mr. Salucci. The chairperson was requesting that Mr. Salucci's term be extended from 3 to 5 years on the basis that the DINEL's new MOI provided for this. I was advised by the department in an advice memorandum on 5 June 2013 that in fact, DINEL's MOI was not explicit on the term of a CEO and that therefore the department's guidelines on the appointment of CEOs should be followed if DINEL wanted Mr. Salucci's term extended. According to the guidelines, the board, in considering the succession plan for the position, should have prepared an annual report to me, which should have included the status of the CEO's contract, the CEO's performance assessment, and the board should also have been able to show how it had ensured that the performance scorecard of the CEO had been aligned to shareholder compact targets. I was of the view that I could not approve the board's request until the board had undertaken the proper procedure provided for in the guidelines and provided sufficient motivation. At the time, this had not yet happened. I therefore addressed a letter to Mr. Zoli Kunene in June 2013, in which I raised my concerns. My concerns were subsequently addressed, with the board reiterating its support and satisfaction with Mr. Salucci's performance. On the 22nd January 2014, I therefore gave my approval of the board's decision to extend his term to 5 years, after which cabinet was informed. That concludes my submissions on DINEL, and I will now turn to Transnet regarding Transnet. Regarding Transnet, I intend to address board appointments, Brian Mulife's appointment, the proposal of Mr. Iqbal Sharma's appointment to the position of board chair, and related appointments. Chairperson, at Transnet at the time, non-executive directors were appointed to the board by the shareholder representative on generally a 3-year term, which was confirmed annually at the AGM. As for the appointments themselves, the board was responsible for the appointment of the MD, who was referred to as the CEO, after consultation with the shareholder, and the board appointed the CFO and informed the shareholder. At Transnet's AGM in July 2010, which was prior to my arrival at DPE, it was resolved that the non-executive directors at Transnet be reappointed for a period of 1 year on acting appointments until the finalization of a review of the board, which was to be conducted by the department. The following non-executive directors were reappointed for a 1 year period. They are listed there: Professor Everingham, Ms. Matyumza, Dr. Haste, Ms. Nununchingila, Mr. Hankinson, Ms. Gaba, Mr. Hubert, Ms. Ramon, and Mr. Moy. When I arrived at the DPE, the Transnet board was in effect an acting board, operating on 1 year appointments that had been made at the AGM. The review conducted by the department had revealed that the Transnet board had a similar problem to the Eskom board that I described earlier. The majority of the directors had been serving for a longer period than was permitted. After the AGM, and on 9 December 2010, therefore, I issued letters of reappointment only to three NEDs for continuity and company stability. They were Mr. Peter Moyo, who is currently the CEO of Old Mutual and is a former executive chairman of Vodacom, Ms. Nunu Chingila, currently the CEO of Facebook South Africa and on a leading advertising executive, and Ms. Nolwazi Qaba, currently a partner at Adams & Adams. I also appointed 12 new NEDs to ensure that vacancies on the board were filled. These appointments were Mr. Mafika Mkhwanazi, who had been CEO at Transnet, Mr. Don Mkhwanazi, former president of the Black Management Forum and leading transformation advocate, Mr. Peter Malungani, Mr. Israel Skosana, both of whom are leading entrepreneurs, Ms. Nazmira Mula, note the spelling there, Ms. Nazmira Mula, senior executive and economist with Investec Asset Management, Mr. Fanushi, Ms. Doris Tepe, also a leading executive in South Africa, Professor Julian Schrempf, former CEO of Daimler Chrysler, Mr. Iqbal Sharma, former DDG at DTI and head of Trade and Investment South Africa, Ms. Thembeka Mnyaka, former deputy president of the Black Management Forum and Entrepreneur, Ms. Ellen Shabalala, and Mr. Gazendam. Here I would like to explicitly counter the narrative that these board appointments were incompetent or aimed to weaken Transnet. Among these board members were many leading and well-respected business people, as I have tried to outline through their brief resumes. We certainly attempted to appoint strong and competent boards. As government, we appreciate the need to reform oversight of state-owned companies, and there are processes underway to standardize appointments of boards and executive management. We therefore welcome any lessons in this regard, which will emerge from this inquiry. It is important, however, that the inquiry concerns itself with what you could have known at the time when making appointments. If people we appointed went on to do wrong things later, we cannot be held accountable unless there is something about their profile which could have been detected at the time we appointed them, which showed they were likely to do wrong things. Chronologically, the next appointment was that of Mr. Brian Molefe into the position of CEO. Again, in relation to this position, I reiterate that the board appoints the CEO only in consultation with me. On the fact before me at the time, he was a stellar candidate. He was a former DDG at National Treasury and former CEO of the PIC, where he had been appointed by the then Minister of Finance. Mr. Molefe was highly regarded in the financial sector at the time, and markets reacted very positively to his appointment, as he was regarded as credible, highly skilled and experienced. That concludes my submission on Mr. Brian Molefe. I now turn to Mr. Iqbal Sharma and the attempt to have him appointed as chair of the board. There were some interrelated movements and appointments on the board, so I will address those simultaneously for the purpose of completeness. It began in May 2011 when I received a decision memorandum from the acting DDG Transport in DPE, in terms of which I was advised on the proposed appointment of new NEDs to the Transnet board. I was given their names and profiles. I signed a cabinet memorandum seeking cabinet's approval on the appointment of one, Ms. Yasmin Forbes, Mr. Nisi Kubi, Mr. Almir D'Souza, Ms. Mapeto Mohuba, and Mr. Iqbal Sharma as chairman and NED. I will deal firstly with Ms. Forbes and Mr. Chubi as insofar as there is interest in those appointments. In terms of the decision memorandum, I was advised that there were two vacant positions on the Transnet board. The first had been reserved for a rail specialist, and the second had become vacant after Professor Schwem resigned from the board in February 2011. After Schwem's resignation, a skills audit was conducted and it was found that the board had skills deficits in two areas. The first was the rail risk management and pipes or port sections, and the second was the risk and audit committees. The board was of the view that a person with an ICT background should be appointed to fill the gap on the audit committee, but the department took the view that someone with port management experience would be more effective given the difficulties faced by Transnet at that time. Notwithstanding the department's feeling that someone with port management experience should fill the vacant post, they were willing to accept an ICT candidate. As such, they recommended the appointment of Ms. Yasmin Forbes, who has the IT experience, and Mr. Chobi, who was the rail expert that the first post had been reserved for. I will deal now with the suggested appointment of Mr. D'Souza and Mr. Mohuba. To this extent, the memorandum advised me that Mr. Don Mkwanazi should retire on the 24th June 2011 AGM at the 24th June 2011 AGM to be replaced by Ms. Mohuba. The reason for this was that his skill set was not considered unique. It was a duplication and therefore unnecessary on the board and an unnecessary expense. Whereas Ms. Mohuba was the owner and MD of Meriteng Investment and had a wealth of business, operational and executive experience. I was further advised that Mr. Almir D'Souza should be appointed as an additional NED of the Transnet Board. He was a project lawyer at Oricon and his skills were in legal, international trade, public-private in partnerships and project finance. Let me now finally come to Mr. Iqbal Sharma. I was advised that Mr. Mafika Mkwanazi, the chair at that time, should be replaced with Mr. Iqbal Sharma. Before I deal with Mr. Sharma, it may be prudent to explain why the board was possibly going to be in need of a new chair in the first place. The reason given in the memorandum to me for the termination of Mr. Mkwanazi's chairmanship was that prior to being chairperson, he had been a CEO of Transnet, and that as there should be a strict line between executive and non-executive functions of the board, the department advised that a chairperson who was a former CEO could create difficulties. Consequently, it was therefore anticipated that a replacement chair would be necessary. The reason for Mr. Sharma's proposed appointment was related purely to his skills. At the time, Mr. Sharma was a well-regarded businessman. He was the former DDG or CEO of Trade and Investment South Africa in South Africa's Department of Trade and Industry. He was responsible for having led the development and implementation of trade and investment policies and strategies. He had also previously headed up the Trade Policy Division, overseeing South Africa's global economic strategies, managing South Africa's bilateral trade relations and negotiations. Prior to working with the DTI, he worked for large multinationals such as Pepsi Company and the Bank of America. I recall that he was hailed by the media as one of South Africa's most remarkable entrepreneurs. It was on this basis that I did not register my objection to his proposed appointment. In any event, the issues relating to Mr. Mkwanazi were resolved, and he continued as chair, which rendered the debate as to his successor moot. Cabinet consequently rejected Mr. Sharma's appointment as chair, but approved his appointment as a non-executive director. At the time when I signed off on the cabinet memorandum recommending Mr. Sharma's appointment, no information relating to any questionable Gupta association had been brought to my attention. I signed off on his proposed appointment purely on the basis of his skills. I reject, therefore, the assertion that Cabinet did not appoint Sharma as chair on the basis that he is a Gupta ally. That concludes my submissions on Mr. Sharma, and I would like to deal next with Mr. Singh's appointment as CFO. Chairperson, on the 14th of December 2011, I received a letter from Mr. Mkwanazi regarding the CFO position at Transnet. At the time, the position was that Mr. Anoj Singh had been the acting CFO since March 2009 after Mr. Wells, Chris Wells, was promoted from CFO to acting CEO. This was before I was appointed Minister of Public Enterprises. In November 2011, the Transnet Board mandated the Corporate Governance and Nominations Committee to finalize the appointment of the CFO and consult me in accordance with their MOI. According to the letter, the board had conducted their processes and recommended Mr. Singh for the position of CFO. I was also advised by the department that Mr. Singh had been at Transnet since 2003 and had institutional memory, that the position of CFO had been vacant since 2009 and Mr. Singh had been acting in that position since that date. It was also obvious that Mr. Singh possessed the appropriate skills and experience for the role, and that appointing a new CFO might stabilize Transnet just before it embarked on a massive build project. I informed Mr. Mkhwanazi that I concurred with the appointment of Mr. Singh. To conclude on this point, Mr. Singh was already acting CFO at Transnet when I arrived at the DPE. His profile clearly sets out that his career progression at Transnet was highly commendable, and there were no complaints about either him or his personal and business association. Further enhancing his profile was that he had served on boards such as Nedbank, the Land Bank, and Telkom. At the time, any Gupta connections that he had were unknown to me. On the facts as they were before me at that time, I would have had no justification for rejecting the appointment of Mr. Singh, even if I was empowered to do so. With respect to the board chaired by Mr. Ben Ngubane, this board was appointed after my tenure, if I'm not mistaken, around 2015. I was no longer Minister of Public Enterprises at the time. I was Minister of Home Affairs. That concludes my submissions on board appointments at these three state-owned companies. I have then lastly been requested to inform the committee of any Gupta-related contracts that were concluded during my tenure at DPE. This topic is challenging, as the extent of Gupta-related corruption is only now surfacing. It is becoming increasingly apparent that even tenders that appeared lawful at one stage may have been tainted. The best I can do, therefore, is to address the tenders that occurred at Eskom, Dinel, and Transnet during my tenure, which have attracted significant media attention. At Eskom, the primary issues that have attracted attention were Trillion, the Richmond Saga, and Tegeta. All of these occurred outside of my tenure at DPE. I cannot therefore comment on them. The only interaction I had in relation to Tegeta is when I ordered a forensic investigation in 2017 as the Minister of Finance. Insofar as the steam generator tender is concerned, I provided the relevant information earlier. At Dinel, the only Gupta-related contract I am aware of as being reported was the proposed VR Laser Asia partnership, which happened after my tenure as Minister of Public Enterprises. The Dinel Asia was not on during my tenure at DPE. As the Minister of Finance, I did not approve the Section 54 application. In fact, I had a meeting in Durban with Dinel, in which I requested that they withdraw from the court application and totally withdraw from the Dinel Asia deal, as this was not in the interest of the country. I have no recollection of the T-Systems contract. I am of the view that this was not during my tenure. I have, however, requested DPE to provide the documents in this regard to ascertain this. If it was during my tenure, I did not approve this. At Transnet, the pertinent issues that arose under my tenure at DPE was the Transnet application for 1064 locomotives and the sponsorship of the New Age Business Breakfast. I will deal with each of these below. I'm going to outline my role relating to the locomotives tender. I trust that this will clarify the extent of my involvement and consequently and necessarily dispel any notion that I was in any manner involved in preferring or selecting suppliers. On 2 May 2013, after having so resolved on 25 April 2013, Transnet submitted a Section 54 PFMA application to me to approve the acquisition of 1064 locomotives, 465 diesel and 599 electronic locomotives. That electric locomotives, that was estimated to cost 38.6 billion rand over a 7-year period to allow the aged fleet to be replaced. This was above the materiality threshold. On 13 June 2013, I received a decision memorandum from the DDG Transport advising me of Transnet's application for approval to invest 38.6 billion rand in the acquisition of the locomotives. The locomotives were for Transnet Freight Rail's general freight business. In terms of the memorandum, I was advised to sign the letter to the chair approving the application. The business case that was made out was, in summary, the following. First, there had been no investment in general freight business locomotives between 1992 and 2008. Second, the average life of the fleet locomotives was 32 years, whereas the design life of a locomotive is 30 years. Third, 374 of the locomotive fleet were expected to be written off within 7 years. Fourth, the above was unworkable, considering that Transnet's market demand strategy had projected a 90 million ton growth in GFB. It was necessary to replace the aging fleet if the market demand strategy was to be realized. Fifth, furthermore, GFB was expected to grow by 9% by 2018-19, and the majority of growth would be generated by rail-friendly bulk commodities such as manganese, manganite, and iron ore. Further, coal transport was expected to shift from road to rail transport. Sixth, historically, the GFB unit in TFR had been plagued by inefficiencies because of the aged locomotive fleet. As a result, TFR planned to invest 194 billion rand over a 7-year period, of which 143 billion rand was allocated to GFB. It was hoped that this would lead to increased customer satisfaction and stop the customer exodus from rail to road freight. Seventh, the aging fleet was a serious problem. The fleet plan showed that the fleet would decline from 1,889 in 2014 to 1,692 by 2019, and a further 50% reduction in the fleet would occur within 10 years after that. With a fleet that size, TFR would only have been able to meet 50% of its MDS target. Eighth, the procurement of the locomotives and other rolling stock would provide Transnet and the rest of the country a unique opportunity strategically to reposition the rolling stock industry for localized assembly and localized manufacture of component parts. And the project was also aimed at increasing localization of manufacturing. In summary, the new locomotive purchase was going to create value for Transnet by enabling Transnet to achieve their MDS target, resulting in a positive NPV, top-line growth, enhanced return on assets, an improved environmental footprint, an increase in operational efficiencies, and it would assist in an anticipated shift from road to rail. Aside from the benefits to Transnet, there were also numerous benefits to the economy, such as 68 billion rand in localization benefits due to the local content requirements, the catalyzing of the development of a locomotive production industry, the development of manufacturing skills, and creation and preservation of jobs. In terms of governance on the project, I was advised that an enhanced governance process was in place for the acquisition, and that this included the establishment of a locomotive steering committee, which was mandated by Transnet's executive committee and chaired by the group CEO. The purpose of the LSO was multidimensional and included monitoring business case development, recommendation of the business case for approval to the relevant authorities, procurement and tender processes, negotiating contracts and tenders. Over and above that, a governance framework had been developed specifically for this transaction and included high standards of confidentiality. I was satisfied with the business case, and I approved the memorandum on 3 August 2013. On the same date, I wrote a letter to Mr. Mkhwanazi, granting the approval sought, citing certain conditions. There were three conditions. The first was that Transnet would provide me with a clear statement with regard to Transnet Engineering's vision in the locomotive supply chain and what capabilities would need to be developed to make this a reality. The second condition was that they would supply me with Transnet Engineering's 7-year locomotive supply chain strategy. The third condition was that Transnet would provide a clear plan as to the strategic fit of this locomotive procurement to the broader road to rail migration objective. And the last condition was that I would be provided with a view of the localization strategy. Transnet Engineering subsequently provided the information sought, and they met with the department on the 28th February 2014. After this meeting and on the 11th March 2014, I received a decision memorandum from the DDG Strategic Partnerships in which I was advised that in light of the discussion and information provided, the department was satisfied that the procurement process and negotiations that were underway sought to achieve and address the industrial development objectives nationally. However, the department at that stage registered its concerns about TE's role as opposed to the role of the private sector in procurement, which was later resolved. Subsequent to this, there were tender-related delays in the acquisition of the locomotives. Although tenders closed in April 2013, PFMA approval was only granted in August 2013, and tender negotiations could not commence until PFMA approval had been attained. It was thus expected that contracts would only finally be awarded by February 2014. The acquisition of the 1064 locomotives was running at least a year behind schedule. As a result of the delay, there was a revenue shortfall which was exacerbated by the delay of locomotive delivery. Because of this, and in April 2014, I received an application from Mr. Mkwanazi requesting approval for the acquisition of 100 dual voltage electric locomotives for an export coal line at an estimated cost of 4.840 billion rand. I was informed that this acquisition was initially approved by the board on 24 January 2014 at an estimated cost of 3.8 billion rand, which was within the board's threshold. However, after the contract negotiation process, it transpired that the estimated total cost of the investment would be 4.840 billion rand, which required shareholder approval under Section 54 of the PFMA. The 100 locomotives would be deployed on the coal export line, which would release 125 locomotives to be used in the GFB, protecting revenue in the GFB and allowing growth. What I have just stated here was the extent of my knowledge of the locomotives tender at the time. I had no other information. I did not know who was involved in the bidding process and therefore interfered in no way. My involvement in the process was in granting the PFMA authorization. I would like now to move on to the new age sponsorship breakfast and to clarify the measures taken by myself and the department in an attempt to curb this issue. In early 2011, numerous state-owned companies informed the department that they were receiving requests from other government departments and state-owned companies to provide them with information about the SOCs to provide sponsorships and purchase flight tickets. I was informed that the SOCs, who were trying to foster good intergovernmental relations, were finding it difficult to decline the requests that were being made, and they requested the DPE's intervention. Around the same time, I became aware that the New Age wanted sponsorships from Transnet and Eskom for business breakfast. I was upset about these sponsorships because it was a large sum of money, even though it was below the materiality threshold and was strictly within the operational purview of the board. I felt it was inappropriate that such large sums of money were being spent on breakfast sponsorships, especially in the midst of such large-scale build projects that were being undertaken. I considered all of the above, and I issued instructions to the chairs of the state-owned companies that all such sponsorship requests and requests for information must be routed through the department in the future. By 2013, the department had escalated and the problem had escalated and the public protector had initiated an investigation into the matter. I was informed that the public protector's main focus was an investigation into fruitless and wasteful expenditure at Eskom, Transnet, SABC and Telkom, and the allegation that the department exercised undue influence on those companies in deciding to sponsor the TN8 breakfast. It is apparent from what I've just stated and from the written instructions that I sent to the chairs of the state-owned companies that I was doing the opposite of militating in favor. I was doing the opposite of militating in favor of the, excuse me, of the TNA sponsorships. I was in fact highly incensed by the news that had reached me. In issuing the written instructions, I did the best I could to curb such requests for sponsorship, but the reality is the accounting authority of the board and of state-owned companies are solely responsible for preventing fruitless and wasteful expenditure. The boards of state-owned companies were therefore solely responsible for having measures in place to ensure that the sponsorship of TNA breakfasts were consistent with approved policies. The boards would ordinarily have records related to this sort of expenditure readily available, and they are the only ones who can account for them. Needless to say, in relation to the public protector's investigation, full transparency was expected from the DPE to assist her. The majority of the information requested by the public protector was in the possession of the state-owned companies board. I therefore requested the state-owned companies to release all requested documentation directly to the public protector. Under the PFMA, I was empowered to instruct the state-owned companies to cede the information to me directly, but I felt that this would be inappropriate given the allegations of undue influence already being made against the department. I further addressed a letter to the public protector affirming mine and the DPE's full support of the investigation and further informed her of the fact that I had requested that the state-owned companies cede the information requested directly to her office. This brings my submissions to an end. I am hopeful that the account that I have given this committee will vindicate me in relation to the issues that I have been called here to account for. During my DPE tenure, I wanted my legacy to be one of decisive and fair action to focus on a new vision for state-owned companies aimed at addressing localization, industrialization, and transformation in state-owned companies, their supply chains, and their customers and their suppliers, and I acted accordingly. I made decisions to ensure good governance, and I appointed people who I viewed as competent to fill some very important roles in the state-owned companies that were under the DPE portfolio. I am severely disappointed that those roles appear to have, in certain instances, been abused. I regret any role that I inadvertently played in the appointment of any director who subsequently failed to prioritize the interests of the relevant state-owned company and, more importantly, this country. At the time, I acted on the facts available before me and made what I thought at the time were meritorious appointments. I, at all times during my tenure at DPE, working together with Mr. Tsidiso Maduna, who was a very competent Director General that I appointed upon my arrival and who remained in the department until I had left, I acted together with him and other officials in the department in the interest of the state-owned companies and of the public. At no time did I interfere with board appointments, committee constitution, or tenders during my tenure. I reaffirmed my commitment to the constitution, to the public, and as a result to this process. And I thank the committee and citizens watching at home for their patient attention. And I will now take the questions, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Minister. And members, can we just take a 5 minutes break? 2 minutes break, not 5 minutes, 2 minutes break. Then after that, we will consider questions.